This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guests tonight are Nicole Brown, a Kentucky poet who will be reading from her book, Sister, and Adam David Miller. When Adam David Miller was 19 years old, he typed a note that read, "I would like to know you better," and passed it on to a girl he liked who worked in a store in his hometown of Orangeburg, South Carolina. Miller is black. The girl was white. As a result of that innocent note, he was accused of attempted rape and thrown in jail. Later, he was forced to leave his hometown permanently. On tonight's show, Adam David Miller will read from his Saroyan Prize-nominated memoir, Ticket to Exile, which was published last year by Heyday Books. Miller has worked in Northern California in the arts for 4 decades as a teacher, writer, poet, editor, publisher, and radio and television producer. His Dices or Black Bones won the 1970 California Teachers Association Award for Best Anthology. He has traveled in West Africa as a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellow and has been invited to read, lecture, and present workshops in schools and universities throughout the United States and elsewhere. You might want to mark on your calendar right now that he will be reading at the Santa Rosa Junior College on Monday, April 6th at 12:15 p.m. in Newman Auditorium. Let's go now to Adam David Miller. And welcome, Adam David Miller. I'm so happy to have you here.
I'm happy to be here.
Your book, which was published in 2007 by Heyday Books, recounts your coming of age in Orangeburg, South Carolina. It was during the Depression era, which has a lot of meaning for this book, but that was bad enough. But more significantly, it was during pre-civil rights South Carolina. And the first chapter of your book begins with your poem, Illumination. And I'd like to ask you to read that poem as a way to begin.
Thank you. Illumination. It read, "Burn this. Burn this," it read. They would not let her. They snatched it, what I had handed her. Evidence, they called it. Trapped between them and me, being one of them, her smile of friendship cracked. Dear light terror flashed in her eyes. "Burn me," it said. Before her eyes, the store began to swim. She clutched the counter. Hold on now. She had no place to run. Carry this message in your heart. Reduce the written words, their searing innocence, to ash. I would like to know you better. Everything we know says, no, you must go. Outsider, inside with us, nice nigger, Kaffir, Dalit, untouchable. Today you run or you burn.
Searing innocence, what a phrase that is. Immediately following the poem, you write the first 2 words of the memoir, "I hurt." Did you know when you first wrote those 2 words that you'd be writing an entire book?
I didn't know how much of an entire book I would write, but I did know that I was going to confront the incident directly for the first time. I had tried prior to this to come at it around the edges. I tried to deal with it in fiction, for example. Mm. I tried to imagine what it would be like if I were, as a professor, going back to the town and lecturing, perhaps, and her mother came, or she came, or somebody came and spoke to me later,
right,
and what would that would be like. So, well, I tried to do it that way. I couldn't do it.
Well, following those 2 words, "I hurt," you write, "I did not realize it then. At 19, the first part of my life was ending." Let's let our listening audience know who you wrote this note to and why your life was ending. Would you read from Mid-Morning, I Folded the Note?
Mid-Morning, I folded the note and closed it into its fold, 2 wood matches for her convenience to burn it when she had read its contents. With a note in my pocket, I told Fess and Charles that I was going around the corner to the dime store. She appeared pleased to see me, but surprised when I handed her a note, which I did quickly. She was not alone in the store, but there was no one near her when I handed it to her. I had come to the store dozens of times over the years, always to buy something. My coming into the store would invite no comment. An extended stay without buying anything would. Had I bought an item or asked about one for a friend or for my mother, I might have been able to slip her the note at the cash register unobserved. She could have said yes or no. Her decision might have remained between her and me. Something in her face, was it distress? Gave me my first misgiving. All the way back to our shop, I wished I could take it back. I had not thought this through enough. Having taken no one into my confidence, I had no one to confide in. With growing apprehension, I realized that I did not know her. My note said as much. She had come into our shop on Broughton Street with her shoe repair needs, a pair of lifts, new soles, a shine, perhaps half a dozen times over several months. On the 2 occasions we were alone in the shop, we'd been open and friendly with one another. Our talk personal, but not intimate. We talked of nothing that would bracket us in any way, except our common dissatisfaction with our situations. Something in her reminded me of country rather than city. I didn't think she was an Orangeburg girl. I had talked to her and she to me, but we'd never talked about us. Our fingers had touched once, briefly. That touch had seemed to send slight tremors through us both, and I had held her feet in my hands after we had put lifts on her Cuban heels. While I was smoothing out her socks, she lay back in the chair with her eyes closed. But I had never said to her, "Hey, I think you're a nice girl." Never had she said to me, "You're a nice fellow." I do not know what she felt when we talked, or what she felt as she walked around the corner to her job, if her step was lighter. She was just entering the world of work and womanhood, high school graduate, 18 or 19, more healthy and strong than pretty, face lightly freckled, filling out into the woman's body she would keep until her first pregnancy. I liked the way she moved. "I don't intend to spend the rest of my life fondling lingerie and folding baby daddies, that's for darn sure," she had told me one day when we were talking about that dime store job. Our restlessness struck a common chord. Neither of us was being fulfilled by the jobs we held. We both wanted something more. Since I never accepted racial superiority in anyone, I could feel no condescension in her manner. Her smile as she left was genuine. She always looked directly at me. We were about the same age. I thought our finger touching had jolted us. I could have been imagining things, but I'd swear the atmosphere was charged each time she came into the shop. I wanted to know her better, but I did not know her. He put the note in the pocket of his smock and looked around her to see if she had been seen. He had. One of the older women clerks asked what it was I'd given her. When she handed over the note, it was immediately taken back to the mail manager, who called the chief of police. Hardly had I settled into work when the chief and his lieutenant came to the shop looking for me. I'd been planning to buy a suit the chief had outgrown for $9, as soon as the women in his house finished altering it to my size. For a fleeting moment, I thought that he was bringing me news of it when he came into the shop, and would have held that thought were he alone, but I knew it did not take two of them to bring me news of the suit. I knew why they had come and prepared myself to accompany them. Both Fess and Charles were in the shop. Fess, face in shock and outrage, snatched off his apron and was about to start towards the front of the shop, the customer area. Except to bring work, police had never come into his shop. He could not imagine them coming, and certainly not for me. "What did he do?" Bess asked the chief. I'd taken off my apron, folded it, and laid it on my workbench. I put my key to the door on the counter near the cash register. I looked at Fess briefly. I could not look long. It was warm, so I had no jacket. I wore a shirt and trousers. My wallet was at home with my Sunday clothes. There were a few coins in my pocket that hit the counter where wrap shoes were kept as I passed, and a balled-up handkerchief. "He know what he done, don't you, boy?" They waited for me in the front of the shop, their bulk suddenly filling the entire space.
So here you were in Orangeburg, South Carolina, a 19-year-old African-American young man giving a note to a young white woman, and you ended up being arrested for attempted rape?
Attempted rape, yes.
That was the charge.
Yes, when the sheriff, they took me over to the county jail, which is a more secure place than the local jail. And the sheriff asked the chief, what do you think we should charge him? And they said, attempted rape, I reckon. That's all right and come to.
And the cops assumed that you had an accomplice because of this typewritten note. They didn't think that a black man could have the intelligence or the skill to type a note. Is that correct?
Well, there's some kind of ignorance that is cultural, that is cultural psychological, that prevents certain people from believing certain things, even though the evidence in front of their face is telling them something different.
Well, one of the interesting parts about this note you gave the girl is that you included matches. Burn this. So you knew that it was a dangerous act. And your mother asked you, what were you thinking? What were you thinking? You were just feeling the relationship that you knew was there.
Yeah, right? I didn't think much.
Yeah.
Obviously, I didn't think enough.
it just felt like the right thing to do, worth taking a risk for, I guess.
I guess.
Well, you were born in 1922.
Yes.
And this book was published in 2007. Why did it take so long to write this book? And what was it like writing it for you, you know, emotionally? Did you have to stop a lot or...
No, actually, the writing, I didn't stop a lot, no. There were some things I had to work through to see where I needed to go with them. But once I started writing, once I opened the wound, the pus just came out. And so there was not a problem with that.
It was time. And you hadn't told anyone about this incident until now.
No. Well, the thing is, it was real trauma, the incident, and so I was frozen. Mm-hmm. Part of me was actually locked off. And this thing happened. I was taken away from home, from people, from friends, from everyone, just whisked away.
And you were 19. And how old are you now, if I may ask?
I'm 86.
Well, the story of your note, your arrest, and your ultimate exile from Orangeburg is presented as a type of braid in your work. You have many other stories that are woven in with this one in the book, some of them painful and some of them are very humorous also. You've had a very full life. And the book is full of interesting people. The men you worked with in the shoe repair shop were kind of extended family.
Well, there were the boss of the shoe repair shop acted as perhaps a father surrogate in some ways, because my stepfather was away at the time and had been away on and off during most of my life. So I respected Fess, who was the owner of the shop, and I liked the way I was being treated by the people in the shop. And I did my work and did it well, and so it was appreciated.
You did all kinds of work, too. I mean, it was a shoe repair shop, but they sent you on some pretty interesting errands, too.
Yes, well, I was...
To their wives, I'm thinking.
Yes, well, what happened is, one can picture 1942, a small, relatively small town, maybe 15,000 people in the South, where we have this family and a... People walked a lot. I mean, there weren't cars or rode a bicycle. And where I was, part sort of the extended group of people who were community workers and so on, so that I did errands like take notes to his wife when he had to not be away, to not come home, and took groceries to the house. So this is not an unusual practice. Or delivery boys, they deliver whatever there is.
Whatever was needed, yeah.
Yes.
I'd like to, if it's okay, I'd like to turn to your mother for a minute. She, first of all, the picture in the beginning, very beginning of the book is just absolutely astonishing. I have stared and stared at that picture. She is such a strong looking woman and has such focus in her eyes. And she's someone who read you long narrative poems as a child, parts of which apparently you can still recite. And it's such a beautiful way to evoke her memory after all these years. It wasn't surprising to read that she used traditional West African medicine to cure fevers and that kind of thing. But you aren't the only one in your family who was jailed wrongly. Your mother was once jailed. She was charged for adultery for having... a man in her room. They were both fully clothed. What was that? What happened?
Well, we lived next door to a sanctified church. And we called them Holy Rollers because they rolled into the aisles when they were when the Spirit was upon them, and so they were generally known as Holy Rollers. Well, the minister there saw a man come into my mother's house one Sunday morning. And told the police that there was a man in that house, and that woman and that man must be doing something. So the police, having been told by a minister of the gospel that my mother was entertaining a man, came to our house and took my mother away and took the man away. And despite their protestation, you know, they were fully closed. We had a tiny house, and I've gone back. I was back there last month or so.
Oh, I was going
to
ask you about
that house.
Yeah.
And I saw that room and how small it was. And so the rooms in the house were so small that there was no place to entertain anyone. We had boarders in the house in other rooms. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, my room was in the back. I mean, it was... Anyway, so they took her off to jail. And then I went with my bicycle to see her and talk with her. And then go to my boss and get money for her bail.
Uh-huh.
And of course, then the poor man had no money for bail. So he was sent to the chain gang for 30 days and given, so we got 30 days free labor for the county. Of course, we never saw him again.
You have beautiful poem in your book called My Mother Washed Other People's Clothes. Would you go ahead and read that?
My mother washed other people's clothes. Sometimes I feel I hand wash clothes to be near my mother. I feel her blood pulsing through mine as I press down and pull up, press and pull, scrubbing. Sometimes I work the board, but mostly I use my fingers, press and pull our arms and shoulders. She scrubbed that we could eat. How she stood it when the trapped blonde pushed her. We are both pushed, he by the blonde, I by my desire to excel. I could pay someone or take clothes to the laundromat, but I love the smell of sunshine wash. In some things, I take the easy way, but when I want to feel my mother, I have to slip into her rhythm. The blonde boss lady was expected not to work, but to direct folk like Mama, Southern and Black, before the Civil Rights Revolution. It was not a job my mother loved. She was a people, not a thing, person. She aspired to nursing, and she had us four, feed. Through the gray weather, the line of clothes was never clean, never dry enough. She heated the smoothing iron on coals never hot enough. Her ashes smudged some things. That woman's whine drive me crazy, my mother would tell us. Husband this and husband that. Beats me for nothing when he comes in from the mill. Says she gets back at him, but don't say how. Mama was a small woman, and the iron was heavy. She talked to my older sister, who was 12, of a juicy roundness, destined too soon to go north, mind babies, cook hash, learn the word Watsa. Told her to hold on. We pulled together with a quarter from the lawn I mowed, my sister's 75 cents for a week's work after school. That's what we had, that and my mother's pride. I love the smell of sunshine wash, and I feel my mother as I squeeze it out.
So you were thrown in jail for this note that you wrote a white girl that simply said, I would like to get to know you better. That's all the note said. You were thrown in jail for attempted rape. How long did you actually spend in jail?
I think about 3.5 days. It was a short stay given the time that people can spend in jail.
3 days, that probably felt like 3 years.
It felt like a very long time, actually.
And then when you did get out, you assumed you were going to be able to go back home, but
sure.
That is not what happened. When you got out, what did happen?
Well, I was taken out and placed in a car and a blanket placed over my head, and my lawyer and her friend drove me down out of town, down country in Dorchester County, where my mother's family lived. And I went back to my grandmother's house. And I stayed there for a few days while my mother, apparently with my boss, and had arranged for a ticket for me to New York.
And you didn't get to say goodbye to anyone that you knew. You went from the jail to being covered under a blanket in a car to get out of Dodge. Right. Do you still have, you mentioned that you were in Orangeburg recently, that you saw your old house. Do you still have family and friends from this time down there?
Well, not many. I have people that I knew when I was there. There are a few, but many, most of them have died. And I have one very fascinating acquaintance. When I finished with Tickett, when it was still in manuscript, I wanted to do some fact-checking. So I checked through the colleges to ask some of the people certain things, and was given the name of Mrs. Zimmerman, who was 90-something years old. So about the last man being lynched in town, this Jack's Oak was a block and a half from our house.
The lynching tree.
That was there, during my childhood. So I called and I asked Ms. Zimmerman, do you remember when the last person was lynched in Orangeburg? And she thought for a moment and she said, I think so. In the late 20s or something, 25 or 6, name was Jack. And I said, Yeah, that exactly the time.
So that's when the tree was named Jack's
Oak. Yeah, 1926, the last person was lynched in Orangeburg.
I wonder if you would read the last poem in the book that serves as your epilogue.
Now, this epilogue has two epigrams. And the first one is, I am because we are. Because we are, I am. And that's an Igbo saying. And the Igbo, of course, are a people in Eastern Nigeria, in West Africa. And the second one is called Genius is Community by Albert Einstein. Reflections on what didn't happen and what might have been. Lines to her. They never let her finish that conversation we started. What did happen to you? Who were you, really? Those few times we talked about nothing, really. Yet we hit dissatisfaction at our cores. That dime store job tied to this last. Had we community such that our genius, power, well, you had genius. Genius I saw in the quickness of your mind, the lightness of your walk. What else would you have said to me? What did happen to you? What questions were you forced to answer by your manager, by the law, your parents when you got home? Did they try to link us in some way? Say we had things we had been hiding? We had no such thing. My 7-word note should have shown them that. I would like, not what we have done, to know you better, was what I asked. I wanted to tap that genius, watch it flow, there, glowing as your smile. They would not let us. They would not let you even answer me. Would you have answered? Do you, like me, carry a scar? Did you marry, let children come? Where are you now? This question has been open for me all my life. What did happen to her? I know what happened to me. Questions, jail, exile, the wandering. For 57 years, I told no one. I told no one. No one. An unopened wound kept festering, never exposed to the healing power of sun. The longer a secret is kept, the harder it is to reveal, the more painful to conceal. It was all those years, remember? All those years of moving, 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 even when I stood still. My life ran on a double track. As I aged, I found it harder to stretch and keep my balance. Then one day, after bucking wind and snow, I screamed, "No more of this." I stared at my laptop. I sat. My first words out were, "I hurt." I had said it. I had sliced open an internal storm. I could admit to questions, dialogue with myself. Who knows? Maybe I could begin to return. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all.
Thank you so much. And I want the radio audience to know that that whole last section was recited from memory. Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathy.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Adam David Miller, author of Ticket to Exile. You know, you have some wonderful comments on this book by some people I have a great deal of respect for, Al Young being one, and Ishmael Reed the other. Ishmael Reed has written, Ticket to Exile is a memoir that ranks with the best written by Americans. I would place it on the shelf next to Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery, James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. That says an awful lot, and I really would like to recommend this book. And that concludes my interview with Adam David Miller. As a reminder, he will be reading at Santa Rosa Junior College on Monday, April 6th, 2009, at 12:15 p.m. in the Newman Auditorium. The name of his talk is Four Decades of Writing, Reading, and Teaching. I hope you can make it to meet this fine man, Adam David Miller.
Do I ever cross your mind? Darling, do you ever see some situation somewhere somehow triggers your memory? Huh? And do you ever wonder what became of all the time? Honey, do I ever cross your mind?
Do you ever want to know? Do all dreams go on endlessly, or do they just run down somehow and gradually become a custody? That melancholy jailer for
baby, baby. what became of all the time.
Please tell me, do I ever, ever cross your mind? Do I ever, ever cross your mind?
And that was a little Ray Charles and Bonnie Raitt. Up next, Nicole Brown reads from her novel and verse, Sister. Brown graduated from the MFA program for creative writing at Vermont College and received grants from the Kentucky Foundation for Women and the Kentucky Arts Council. She studied English literature at Oxford University as an English-speaking Union scholar and worked as an editorial assistant for the late Hunter S. Thompson. Here now is Nicole Brown.
My name is Nicole Brown, and I'll be reading Sister. It is a novel and poems that was put out by Red Hen Press in September 2007. And it is the story of two sisters growing up in Kentucky. Each poem is a love poem of sorts, is a letter from the older sister to her younger. There are 10 years between them, and they have different fathers. And I'd like to start with the first poem in the collection. It's entitled Footling. And the only thing you need to know is that footling is a midwife's term for a birth that is feet first. Generally speaking, most breech births are bottom first, but a footling is feet first. So, footling. We have heard her tell the story over and again like this. An early spring tornado, a still yellow sky. Nuns who said, must have felt better going in than it does coming out, as they gave her a hot compress and dimmed the lights for pain. She was half my age now, sweet 16 and barely healed when God smacked half the trees flat, and she curled down under a mattress in an empty bathtub in an empty apartment, a newborn suckling the tips of her fingers. The porcelain, cool, white womb had a drain ready to carry anything it could swallow to the swollen brown Ohio, and though the tub was dry, she used her heel to flip the drain open, asking the river to take it, all of it. Especially that moment the month before when she didn't know better but to sit up and grab the slippery blue feet first, an impossible breach, a twist with a snap that meant leg braces, special shoes, a grown woman who would never walk right in red heels. Frightened in this storm, she wanted the tender word, birth, but knew better now. Birth meant forceps, rips, umbilical cords wrapped around the neck. Birth needed the abdomen for more birth, recovered with douche, singed with a drop or two of Lysol, boiled a set of glass baby bottles in the same pot that made the pinto beans. Not much more to hold, and so she touched the blue leg of her bruised baby, cooed footling, thinking it sounded more like the name of some imp than a complication. Footling, her shape shifter sleeping inside the cup of a trumpet vine. Footling, because she was so young, and who could blame her? Dreaming away and waiting while wind tore the silk of clouds to shreds, plucked off pieces of home, peeled shingles back from rooftops one by one. This next poem is called How She Conceived. And the first poem is the conception or the imagined conception of the narrator, the older sister. And the second is of her younger sister. There are 10 years between them, and They have the same mother, but different fathers. Count 9 months back. Find June. Find the foxfire summer. Find Mama's 15th year, a dark undergrowth of fern and fertile knots of water moccasin down at the creek, high, green, and indifferent to the trying of her new softness in a concrete slick basement where cave crickets fiddled in the moldy dark, or on a rooftop where shingles gripped her, black grit catch on her tender bear. Any place where nobody could hear, nobody could catch her, nobody to switch her ass on home. Or better, 'cause you know her well as I do, giggling, cigarette sneak, mini skirt hike girl she was, where somebody could hear, or barely hear. A custodial closet, knocking splash of mop water running gray, the velvet movie seat, hinges up and creaking, or my choice, an empty baptismal hidden behind stained glass, strong sun spilling blue and red and orange and blue across my daddy's back, and one praying pink hat in the front pew. God love her, fanning with a folded program, old clip-on pearls deaf to their kissing sighs. Oh, the hot, repentant air, too. And you, sister, you know, done respectably. 10 years later, in a bed, soft moaning, flat-backed, missionary, a warm rag and a glass of water to follow. Imagine bright rods of moonlight cutting through blinds to stripe his back. And her pillow, cool to the touch, flipped after a nightmare to try to put her back to sleep. Her panties are folded in cotton. His pinkest skin smells of soap. An amber stereo light shadows simple, familiar things. His watch, wallet, mess of change. Her earrings, bracelets, discarded blouse. A dog stretched unbothered, dreaming at their feet. There's a fan, too, the spinning set on low, and after she stares at the burst of blades until they disappear, blinks her eyes to strobe them back again. Later, they know you are coming through $10 home tests, one line going one way and another line going the other. When I was a kid, my mama, she did hair, which is a little different than thinking of someone working full time in a salon, which was just a little mom and pop place where she cut hair, and which meant that I was sort of raised by her and six gay men, which was just the perfect place for me to be as a child. Unfortunately, it was about that time that the AIDS epidemic started to roll in. And so this next poem, this is about that time. And it's called 1979. That year was the cyanide hiding in the stone of a peach. Look how yellow the photographs, a nicotine sheen on our happy days. A disease roiling out of the Congo to lay flat the tender men before I learned to spell their names. Eric, for example, E-R-I-Q-U-E, with that surprise ending to match his frosted tips. Or Chris, now C-H-R-Y-S-S. His name changed from a Bible school salute to something that rang like a wet finger rimming a genuine crystal glass. They came from the casserole-fed dredge of Kentucky to click and sashay through the salon where Mama doused perm solution on old gray and I sorted yellow rods from pink, where Mama cut a wet ridge held between pointer and middle, and I swept it up, where Mama waxed her own eyebrows clear out of existence, and I pushed pens into a styrofoam wig head, always terrified she might change her hair so much she'd be unrecognizable, impossible to find in the dizzy span of racks at the mall. That was when the shop was filled with nothing more than disco tunes, and, if ever was such a thing, simple childhood fear. It was another year before she got herself a diamond and dropped her scissors in the neon blue for good, leaving right before the wake of purple sores, all those men I'd adored abandoning themselves through the holes of walls, the vending machines of fruit-flavored lube emptied in filthy gas station stalls, the hubcap chained to the key reflecting a future tasting of either latex or death. But I swear to you, when Chris set Mama down to dye her hair and I began to cry, he quit, put the bottle down. And Eric, he scooped me up on his fat lap, said, "Girl, wild horses wouldn't drive that crazy Mama from you. Besides, I promise we'll keep that bombshell blonde." I pressed into his body. He was soft, bruised fruit, and I was blessed to ever know a man's flesh could feel sun warm, smell peach sweet. This poem is called A Cup of Anything. Sister, this is not a code. These words are not to be spoken. This is the way I'm able, describing everything, but I know you don't know me, and I know the cat better than you. How can you forgive me as I've spent more time trickling water between the fat leaves of my jade plant than brushing your hair? That I recall serving the shaking girl who came in on Tuesdays, coffee with one cube of ice, one cube of sugar, and a straw she had to drink through, but I've never poured you a cup of anything I can remember. All I can tell you is that when you were new, the crown of your head broke my heart with the smell of sweet, warm bread. And for those of you not in the South, you might want to know that a root woman is generally someone who can conjure up hexes and whatnot, and you don't mess with the root woman. The root woman. A black woman worked for pay on Friday to feed you mush pears and mush peas and to teach me how indigo paint and colanders keep out haints. How uncut hair and unshaven legs retain strength. How a red ribbon, a brass key, and fire brought love. With her, the growling ghost of my childhood did not return, and your daddy disappeared for good into the basement, building model airplanes and bluing himself with late-night flickerings of television to put him to sleep. She protected me, lioness she was, jumping down barefoot to crack clams off the canal wall and eat them with hot sauce right where she stood, red running to her elbows. She flushed chitlins for dinner, a garden hose running the dark flecks out to settle soft into grass, and fried chicken, marrow sucked straight from the leg bone. I held hot rags to my breast when she said it would make them grow, imagined a red bra, a fast blue motorcycle, a boy's fast black hair flying back into my mouth. 2 years later, she left and they came early enough and barely there, tender swells with airbrush pink nipples. It was then I stole Mama's cigarettes, the ones she wasn't supposed to be smoking, and smoked them out the bathroom window, my lips pressed to the grain of the fly-specked screen. I changed my wardrobe with a handful of rubber bands and a gallon of bleach. It was a poor girl's tie-dye, sister, because we were poor. All of the rings, a faded version of the cloth's original, purple on blue, red on orange, a stained glass shirt fit for my own make-believe stained glass father, worn tight to sneak out to the asphalt black, crushed glass twinkling under street lights. I met one with blue eyes there, watched him spit tobacco in the air, then catch it on his tongue. Somniloquy. Mama sleeps, her body curled tight like the sole of a house shoe hot from the dryer. Mama sleeps, her bent knees bare, her ankleted ankles crossed, one foot on top the other, stacked placid and limp, Jesus style. Mama sleeps, her jaw knocking all night on the same closed door, her canines worn flat with the pop and grit of chewing a thing impossible to swallow. She doesn't like heavy things on her, nothing to weigh her down, so with one thin sheet she sleeps, her hand to her face making an L with her pointer alongside her nose and her thumb tucked under her chin. At first you think it's a vestige from some crybaby comfort time, but look closer. See how the hand steadies her pretty dreaming head, how it holds her pretty pout mouth, keeping it shut. This next poem is titled after an old Texas instrument toy from my childhood, which would probably tell you my age. And it was a toy called Speak and Spell, and it was basically just like a little computer, and it would sort of bark out words at you, and you had to try to type in the right spelling, and it would tell you if you were right or not. And so this is called Speak and Spell. Of course, I always did spell it wrong, 'cause there's no way to speak and spell things right, especially after all those years washing with a wash rag, frying in Earl, stuffing my drawers in a chiffon robe, settling down into a pallet on the floor. And it's true, I got up in front of a crowd, said succulent when I meant succinct. Wouldn't have known better if not for my boss, red-faced, ashamed. All those words I'd read but never heard out loud. All those words we made our own. Go home, sister. Open the kitchen drawer. It's the only place you'll find a thing to write with. Maybe one of his drafting pencils, too square to roll and sharpened with a knife. Maybe a stick of her eyeliner, greasy coal brown. Or maybe under napkins, coupons, and ketchup packs, you'll find that crayon I always used, the daffodil color of spring and so short you have to peel back the last of its paper, have to hold it with the tips of all your fingers to get anything down. I want you to write Petty, P-E-D-I, as in, get those baby shots at the pediatrician, as in, pedicure, as in, the whore got her toes painted red. Then scratch out the I, the singular I, because the point of view doesn't matter anymore, because vowels are tricky. It's already 8 o'clock, we might say, way past time. Add an O, because the O is a mouth, empty and round, a number multiplied to make nothing. Then add the word file, F-I-L-E, as in his cabinet, always locked, never mind what's inside. Then change the F to P-H, those two secret consonants whispering into the phone. The rest is game show simple. Take an E and end it. Who knew there was a word for it, much less a right way to write it down? Pick up that crayon again. Show me what you've learned. Make this into a word. Make it a note left behind. No, the good thing about yellow, it's so light, she'll never see. And to make sure, write it on something she'll read, but read over. A grocery list, a receipt, a Christmas card from me. This poem is actually the last poem that I wrote when I was working on the manuscript. It took me about 7 years to finish this book. And I think when I wrote this one, I knew I was done. And it's called How to Forgive. Plant it in the folds of your intestines where it is warm and dark and swimming. Keep it there in the churning, wormed organs. Hold it still. Claim it your own. Say, this is mine. My garbage, my rot, my rage, and I will not just lay it down. Rock it in your arms and love it till it calms. Rub its demon head with sweet oil and song. Find its facula and stare unprotected into sun. Call your body home. Make room without throwing a single thing out to clutter the world. You are not mercury for the mouths of fish. Not a plume of smoke to lift hollow bones. Do not throw it like a bottle from an overpass into a speeding car. Do not wait for it to seed as you wait tentacled in Sleeping Beauty's hair. Listen to me. I know how it works. Simply bury it, but bury it alive.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guests tonight were Adam David Miller, author of his memoir, Ticket to Exile, published by Heyday Books, and Nicole Brown, author of Sister Poems, published by Red Hen Press. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's show, please do contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. And remember that Adam David Miller will be reading at Santa Rosa Junior College on Monday, April 6, 2009 at 12:15 p.m. in the Newman Auditorium. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. Thanks for listening.